This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, you can always find heroes around you. Oftentimes, we have no idea to what lengths our neighbors have gone to secure the freedom we so easily take for granted. And here on Hometown Heroes, we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget or miss out on learning how heavy a price has been paid for our freedom as Americans. And along the way, we hear things that you might not hear anywhere else. We're educated, entertained, and sometimes even inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And boy, do the stories from prisoners of war grab our attention. A rare occasion this time where we continue the last episode and the story of Bill Overmeyer of Albuquerque, New Mexico. He and his wife, Ann, have enjoyed 66 years of marriage, but they never would have met if he hadn't survived more than 3 years in captivity. Here's where we left off. Bill had retreated from Bataan, avoiding the infamous death march when he boarded a boat for Corregidor. He was captured on the fortified island of Fort Hughes and taken to Corregidor in what was known as 92nd Garage. This is May of 1942. The 92nd Garage had been home to the motor pool for the 92nd Coast Artillery. That's where the name came from. And now this was where the Japanese were holding all their prisoners on Corregidor. Bill, you're 22 years old. I can't imagine the uncertainty and the fear you must have dealt with. How'd you deal with this new reality of being a prisoner of the Japanese?
Just day by day. If the Japanese gave us orders, we did it. If they didn't give orders, we just sat down and worried about food and water. We got the 92nd Garage. One of my buddies, it was the one that I was best man at his wedding. He had some GI rations. I said, "Where'd you get that?" He said, "Right over there. It's such and such, 92nd Garage." And I was as hungry as I could be. I hadn't eaten for 2 or 3 days. And I stood and looked at him, and he just kept eating. And finally I said, "Well, I hope the hell you choke to death." He didn't offer me a thing. Hmm. Our friendship ended right there. We separated. I never saw him again. He ended up at China, a big camp there that had about 2,000. One day the camp was bombed by American bombers, B-29s, that came over. One of the bombers bombed, hung up in the rack. They got over the prison camp, which was not far away. And the bomb came loose and went down, blew up, hit him. Mm. And just filled his lower body with shrapnel. And he didn't live a couple more days. That was the end of him. And getting back to 92nd Garage, I finally got guts enough to go over and steal some of our own GI rations. They had an area on the island of... You could go, and it was leftover stuff like blankets and shaving kits and all that kind of stuff that the Japs had taken from the soldiers. Well, I got a marine blanket. I thought, well, I don't know where we're going to end up, but I'm going to take this marine blanket. And I got a shaving kit, a Schick injector shaving kit that was laying there. I picked it up. It's in the medicine cabinet right now.
You still have it?
I still have it. I brought it back to where I was sleeping, and this other guy, he was there. Anyway, I went and got some cans of GI, had left it there while I'd gone over to get this blanket. I came back, and he was eating the darn cans. I said, that's the last time you're going to eat my food, and I separated from him. Hmm. So I was all alone, and we finally got on a ship, got on at 92nd Garage, went to Manila, got on a train, and they took us up in the northern part of Luzon to a prison camp called Camanatuan Camp 3. This was the fortified island's personnel, and I heard one officer say, "Well, we've got 6,000 men in this camp." So that's how many soldiers were captured in the fortified islands.
Mm-hmm.
Had nothing to do with Bataan and that deal. We were there until one day a Jap soldier came by and said, what did you do in civilian life? He addressed the whole camp. I finally wrote down, I said, carpenter. I had worked for Dad. I'd poured concrete. I'd hammered nails. Dad built some FHA GI houses here in Albuquerque, two batches of them, and I knew how to hammer nails. That's about all I knew. So I put down carpenter. I wasn't doing too good in college, so I didn't put down student. They wouldn't want to hear that. That note carried me all the way to Yokohama, Japan. And I went to work after we got to Japan. We walked 30 minutes every day from Yokohama to Mitsubishi Shipyard. Worked 10, 12 hours daylight to dark. And back 30 minutes past the Yokohama train station, they made me what they call a toritsuke. That's Japanese for carpenter.
Mm-hmm.
A ship's carpenter. Now, a ship's carpenter does a little bit different thing than wood carpenters. But I learned, and they trained me, and I looked at the blueprints one day, and it said U.S. of A. Again, they bought all their stuff, their steel, their blueprints, their method of building ships, battleships, everything they had. They were copying what mm-hmm. what we had done.
And what kinds of things were you doing? What were you working on?
I was working primarily out on the decks. The decks were flat on the ground. There were steel plates. There were hundreds of feet of steel plates laid flat on the dirt. They would take a 40-foot long beam and lay it down on a new steel plate, and then use U-clamps on top of that and a wedge, drive that wedge in there and make the steel beam and the steel plate tight like this.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had some Korean kids about 10 years old that were welders. They all wore yellow uniforms and they were prisoners of war like we were. And they would come with electric welding and they would tack weld that steel plate to that steel beam. And eventually that steel beam would end up on the ship. We worked on one ship. It was a tanker, an oil tanker. And it came in. We worked on it for over a year.
Wow.
Converting it to a small aircraft carrier. Then when we finished our work, they put it in the water, and it was right alongside the dock, tied to the docks. We walked to work one day and heard some explosions going on and planes flying. And man, we couldn't wait to get over to the shipyard and see what was happening. Six SB-2Cs, Navy dive bombers,
mm-hmm.
came in at sea level, rolled over, and sunk that ship right there at the harbor. And it was going glub, glub when we got there. Boy, we were yelling, I'll tell you. The Japs didn't kill any of us, but we were happy.
It's the one time in your life you were really glad that some of your work was destroyed, huh?
Right.
Right. Well, and along those lines, I'm sure a lot of folks at home are listening to this and wondering what that's like when you're working every day. And it sounds like pretty exhausting work. I'm sure they fed you just enough to keep you strong enough to do the work, and I'm sure you weren't treated luxuriously or anything, but you're doing this work day after day after day, and I'm sure there's something in the back of your head that says, I'm doing this, and this is going to be used against my country, my buddies, my military. Was that hard to deal with, and did you ever try to think, boy, is there somehow I could sabotage this somehow or do something to compromise the integrity of what it is we're working on here?
We had to face that every day. We had 300 men in our prison camp. We had 17 nationalities. But some of the guys were on different crews. I was a toritsuke. I worked one-on-one with the honcho. And some of the guys were welders, and some of them were riveters, four-man riveters. I remember hearing several guys say, well, I dropped the rivet gun today and it went into the water and I don't think they're going to find it. He was bragging on it. Mm-hmm. I don't blame him. That's good. We're supposed to do that. But if you're going to die, if you get caught, that's not so good.
That was my next question. Did you ever have a very real example or sense or understanding of what might happen to you if you were caught intentionally messing up the work that you were supposed to be doing?
Yes. I saw a couple guys that were, I don't know what happened at the shipyard, but they brought them back to the camp and they put them in a little tiny thing. It was about as big a square as this, or even smaller. One man would be in there. They couldn't sit down. They couldn't lay down. They had to stand up. They couldn't stand straight up. They were bent over like this, and they were in there for weeks. Mm. Weeks. And we'd have snow at night, and they didn't have anything to keep them warm. Too bad. Too bad. In fact, towards the end of the war, I had a narrow point of view in some respects about how to do the work. And I'd tell them, well, talk to my honcho, and I'd say, let's don't do it this way. Let's do it this way. Turn it over this way and try it and do it this way. And it's so much easier. Nye, nye, nye. No, no, Jirosha, nye. Baquero. And we're not going to do that. We're going to do it the Japanese way. And if we don't do it that way, we're going to die. And it's the way they did it. Mm-hmm. They would die if they couldn't do it. One day, my honcho took me to the main honcho. He tried to talk to me, and I said, nye, nye, let's turn it over. And that set him off. Fujiyama was his name. And he came at me with a cold chisel. Now, they use cold chisels to write on the deck. And they use a chalk to write out things. And this blows up on the deck. And put it with such and such and so on and so forth. American writers would tell them what to do. Mm-hmm. And then they would use this cold chisel and they'd write that same thing and dent it into the metal.
Right.
Well, this big honcho, he had gotten the word from the little honcho about me not wanting to do it the right way. Mm-hmm. So he came at me and it surprised me. He tried to stab me with his cold chisel. It was sharp. It got over my shoulder and broke the back and broke the skin. It wasn't very bad, but it was enough to break the skin. So I just reached up and grabbed his hands. He looked at me and I looked at him, and finally I just turned him loose and he backed up a little bit, and I said to myself, Bill, you've gone too far. And here came a guy that was over there on the deck. He was about 100 yards off. He heard all the talking going on. I didn't understand the Japanese, but he did. He was a Jap. And he came over and he slugged me right in the face, knocked me down, and it didn't hurt me that much. I finally just got up and stood there again. They turned around and walked away. Hmm. They had saved face. And I never realized that that would happen. I didn't know what was going to happen. I thought I was going to get it all. But I didn't. They released me, and I went back to work the next day, and everything was all right.
Wow. I can't imagine anyone listening to this and not being absolutely terrified, just imagining some of the things you're describing here. In general, how did the Japanese treat you? What was life like in the prison camp when you weren't working? Did you have anything to eat? What, can you paint a picture of that existence? Because this is more than 3 years of your life. You lived in captivity. What was it like?
We worked 9 days and got the 10th day off. Now, fleas and lice were rampant. You cannot believe going through life with insects crawling inside your clothes. We spent the day off taking our clothes off, turning them inside out, finding first the lice. They didn't jump, but we could catch them and pop them between our thumbnails. Well, later on, it turned into fleas. we'd find a flea, and by the time we'd start to pop him, well, he'd jump. We'd never catch him. Mm-hmm. But we slept on a straw mat. It was raised up off of the floor, and that's where they came from, I guess. We didn't know where they were. Anyway, we would repair our clothes if you had a needle and thread. And if you didn't have anything else to do, you'd play cards. If you had a deck of cards, you could play bridge. And I got a hold of a book. It was more than maybe a half a dozen books in the whole 300 camp.
But you got your hands on one of them, and I want you to share why that was so significant and what it meant to you. But we need to catch a break here. 94-year-old Bill Overmeyer of Albuquerque, New Mexico, our guest. You'll find some photos of him on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You'll even see Bill throwing out the first pitch at a baseball game just last month. The rest of this prisoner of war story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.